Let's have some fun.
Okay, yes, Patrick.
From the Hill Country of Texas, this is One Radio Network.
Pleasant good evening to you, dear heart. It is January the 29th, 2009, and this is Patrick Timpone. And you've got OneRadioNetwork.com. It's a cold night in Dripping Springs, Texas, wherever you are around the world. Welcome, and I hope you're safe and sound. And we're going to have fun tonight with Michael Tesarian. Michael Tesarian is in Europe somewhere, and he has a mystical school. He's a writer, researcher, and just interested in a lot of things when it comes to finding out what the truth is in the world, in politics, the people that run things. He has a new DVD about control, and we'll talk about that. Mr. Tesarian, welcome, and good morning in Europe. Thanks for staying up for us.
No, you're welcome, Patrick. Nice to be on. Yeah, nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here, sir. You were born in Ireland?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Uh-huh. And what is the relationship with your heritage, Irish origins, which you've written about, and say perhaps Patrick's origins?
Oh, well, when it comes to origins, I don't believe that we've been really told the truth about any of our origins. And that's what my work deals with. I knew Ireland better than other places, of course, growing up there and you know, being so much exposure to going out and looking at the ancient megaliths and studying the ancient Irish legends. And, of course, I had originally thought, you know, that's about just studying Ireland.
Uh-huh.
Little did I know that no sooner do you start looking into the history of Ireland and then you start studying the Gaels and you start end up studying the Celtic, you know, question. And before you know, this takes you well into Europe. And my research has even led me to see that there was a connection of these ancient people into Egypt, into Africa, into the Indus Valley in India, you see. So the thing just wouldn't stop. I mean, you start with one thing,
uh-huh,
and this thing, you know, you don't know what this thing is going to become later on. So it was pretty much not intentional. It was, in fact, a lot of it was completely surprise. It was accident. I didn't have any preconceived ideas, you know, so it just, this study took me into the study of Atlantis. So everything I basically have been doing grew out of just, you know, simple observations that anyone can make in their own land or a study of various things. And geez, this thing just becomes this whole animal, you know, that it's
right.
impossible to believe in the beginning that it'll take you into those directions. But really, basically, the hidden history of Africa, the occult history of America, you know, uh-huh, South America, what have you. You know, they've never really been told. What we're getting in school and so on, it's just, you know, it's not consistent with the facts. So
we just don't have a clue of where we came from or where our bodies came from, at least.
Hey, no, we're learning now. We've got people like Michael Cremo, you know,
sure,
in American context, and we've got you know, Alan and Dallaire, who are looking back into the fossil record with an alternative reading. You know, it's happening. We've got people like, we had people like Barry Fell, the American, you know, researcher, and Ignatius Donnelly, you know. So it's we're at a great time.
I mean,
we are now at the time, for the first time, where we can really learn the truth about our origins, you know. There's a few scholars in the past dabbled with it. They looked into it. They were not wholly accurate, but they had penetrating insight. But today, we're really at the time now where we're learning about the pre-Diluvian cultures. You know, we have people like Graham Hancock literally putting on diving suits and going down under the ocean to film these ancient ruins, you know what I mean? It's the time to really, you know, let the cat out of the bag and have the fact and have the disclosure is now, actually.
Mr. Tesarian, do you have a belief and an experience of yourself as being soul that have incarnated in other lifetimes?
That's a fascinating question, and of course, I have part of my family is from northern India, so of course, you know, I grew up, you know, a little bit. I'm not religious, really, and I'm not, you know, I try in my professional work also, Patrick, to keep metaphysical, abstractia, you know, to a limit. But of course, as you, you know, I've thought about this. It's something that's always on my mind. I have a personal interest in all of these things, but it's something that I really can't really comment about, you see, because it's a tremendous study and reincarnation. What happened was that when I was studying the Druids of Ireland, it actually comes back to what we were saying earlier, I did start to realize, and not just the Druids, but Egyptian, the ancient Egyptian belief systems.
Uh-huh.
It started to look as if we haven't really also been told the truth about subjects like reincarnation. And, you know, because, for instance, in the ancient Druidic teachings, they have what's called the transmigration of souls.
Yes.
Concept. Which is, of course, found in many shamanic peoples. You know, it's found in the American Indians of North America. It's found as far away as India, you see. So there's a little bit difference between the concept of the transmigration of souls, which is a pantheistic idea, meaning that when you die, your energy may, in fact, go back into the living matrix. You may participate, as we're already participating, we're just kind of unconscious of it, into the universal matrix. That is a different theory than what came out of the Brahmin Hindu priest archies of India, this more codified, more patriarchal, little bit more exploitative concept of reincarnation, in which they're saying, well, basically, look, you're a sinner, you have this thing called karma, and this is what keeps you on the wheel of samsara, you know, coming and going. And so I started to see that what most people know when they're reading about reincarnation is really a bunch of priest lip. A very cunningly skewed, cunningly contorted doctrine in order to, again, you know, perpetuate the hierarchy, especially the patriarchal hierarchies. This was not originally taught in the old tantric religions of ancient times. It was not taught by the shamanic peoples who believed that we are now and after death, you know, irredeemably and irrevocably part of the matrix. So there is a kind of an eternal life situation going on, you know.
Yeah,
but it's not exactly what we've been told.
Uh-huh. There are, as you know, around the world, millions of people who have believe that they can remember some of their past incarnations, and some people even back to Lemuria and Atlantis and such. And I was just wondering, when thinking about you this afternoon, that if someone like you or others did not believe that they had once been in other incarnations in other bodies, whether it be 1,000 or 10 or 20 or 30,000 years ago, then what would it really matter about Atlantis and these other places, Mr. Tesarian? If, in other words, I mean, it would just be history, which is dead, which is past, and there's no connection. What would it really matter if we didn't have some kind of spiritual connection with this time?
Well, that's a tremendously great point. Very, very good question. And I've thought about that a lot. And I also always emphasize in my work that it really wouldn't matter if it was a matter of just dry history. So,
just like dead bodies out there, right? Just dead bodies. It's dead. It's gone. What would
exactly.
it matter? What would it matter?
Exactly. Exactly. I have to always address this because I have an interest in history. So what I basically, my answer is that I always remind my audience that I am not that interested in history. I am much more interested in what we are doing now, who we are, you know.
Yes.
And the world, the climate, both politically and socially and spiritually that we find ourselves in now, it's just that everything we are now is the outcome of where we've been in the past, both in a Hegelian way and the movement of history, that we are at the end of a process. History is obviously a process. Or you can look at it, you know, like a mountaintop. You can't have the peak of the mountain. Unless you have the base of the mountain. So everything, we are the product of the past. You're talking about something incredibly mystical about the fact that we may even have even lived in different forms in the past. Again, I've thought about this as a tremendously important question.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the mentors that I had when I was young, at least let's say that, you know, the people who I grew up, you know, studying with, even people in my family, you know, were very, very involved in this. I grew up with the Reverend Paul Solomon, you know, studying him, who was a prophet, who literally did have outer body experiences, in which he spoke about, you know, having been himself taken back in time, and also
uh-huh.
that he believed very strongly that America, for instance, very much in the same way that Edgar Cayce had predicted or surmised, that a lot of people who are born in America are the old Atlanteans, you know, so that this is always very much sort of colored my own work, except that I have not written about it specifically because, as I said, the scope, it's such a huge subject.
Right.
And I like to keep the focus on other things, but it is fascinating to think that there may be, you know, today incarnated souls who are, you know, very old, very ancient, going way back, you know, to previous dimensions and previous times. And we know now that there is even, from the work of, you know, even Carl Jung, say you don't even believe in reincarnation, it won't matter because we have a genetic understanding. We understand there's a thing called race memory. We understand that there's a genetic patterning in which we are the repository of all of the thoughts, even the actions, belief systems of all of the people, you know, that came before us. It's really amazing. It really is.
But you, Michael Tesarian, you have not had any experiences at night and dreams, or where you really saw, I had some kind of evidence that you have been around before as soul in a different incarnation.
Well, I don't really ever discuss my private life, but again, these are, you know, tremendously deep subjects. I would say that all I can tell you is that I know that, you know, the five senses reality is definitely not something that as a child, you know, and as a teenager that I ever really bought into. You know, basically,
you knew there was something else going on.
No question about it.
Yes,
I mean, it very much defines my life. It's not something that's ordinary in any shape or form.
Right, right. Well, why this fascination? And tell us a bit about what did go on in Atlantis and Lemuria, and how long ago was that? And what really went on there? You have a book, very popular, Atlantis: Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation. So, first of all, tell me a bit about what you understand Atlantis was about.
Sure, Patrick. Basically, as I said, my vision opened to the subject in Britain, in Ireland. And the Irish legends are pretty, you know, they've got a lot to say about these ancient times. Because, of course, remember, the Irish legends themselves are old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the times that they're talking about in those legends are even older. So this is a tremendous record, in exactly the same way that we have the, you know, the Babylonian Sumerian record. The thing was that with the Irish record, it hadn't been really delved into. Even the Arthurian legends, certainly the more ancient Irish legends, you know, people had always been treating this just as fairy folk tale. They hadn't taken it seriously. If you go and read that stuff, or you know, read the parts that I've written about, it's totally mind-boggling that you mean to tell me that people didn't notice what, you know, this was all about here. They didn't get it. They just thought that this was like fairy folk tales, and goodness knows. And one of the most fascinating things is that the ancient Irish legends say that there wasn't just one sunken continent. This is one of the first things, because you just mentioned Lemuria and
Atlantis, right?
Right. This is corroborated by the Irish legends that there was not one, there was two, three, four. They even had four. They had about four. And if you add that to a couple of other sunken islands that are spoken of in the Arthurian legend, and there's about three of them, you have up to like already, six or seven lands that are spoken of in just the ordinary readable mythologies of Britain that were lost beneath the sea. This includes Avalon, this includes Lyonesse, and it includes the four Gaelic or the four Irish, land masses. And interestingly, one of those lost lands is known in Gaelic as Murias.
Murias.
Right. Now, you just need to put the letter L, which always has been used, like the French the, you know, like we would put the at
sure.
the front of a word.
Sure.
So the L was always a word that letter that was often added to the beginnings of words that just meant the place. So Murias is obviously very similar to Lemuria or Murias, you know, the motherland, the mother home. It actually means the very same thing in the ancient Gaelic language. So right there. And then what do we find about it? Oh, this just happened to be a place that once existed above the waves and was destroyed in a mighty cataclysm, hence the origin of the Irish people. You see, the ancestors of the ancestors of the Irish are meant to have come from these four sunken, devastated lands, which went down in an enormous deluge. And then check this out. The leader of the people who survived, the leader of the survivors, his name in Gaelic is Nua.
Nua.
Right.
How do you spell
check that? In Gaelic, it's N-U-A-D-A.
Nua.
Or it can be also pronounced N-A-D-A, Nada, right? Or Nuada, or Nua. And this man saved his people, right? He's a king who saved his people by building enormous boats, enormous ships, magical ships, just in the same way that you hear Noah being directed by God to build the ark. The ark was a pretty much magical vessel because, of course, it contained all those animals and what have you.
Uh-huh.
And so the report is that Nuah, and then we have even in another part of the world, Nata, N-A-T-A, who is the only survivor from the ancient flood. You know, so what is this name? It's amazing. And then we find out, I mean, the thing just goes on from there, like I was saying in the beginning. It becomes so fascinating because these survivors arrive on Ireland, and the legends being quite quizzical and quite fantastical, they have this statement in which they say that the land of Ireland grew out of the waters. This is how the myths put it, meaning that it was like a living goddess, that they had only one plain. This is like one field at the time, and then came two fields, and then came three fields, you know, and then came some lakes, and the land magically rose, became born. Now, of course, turn that around, and what that's a description of course, is the waters receding.
Ah, yes.
Makes a plain, two plains, three plains, and finally you have a larger landmass. So again, it might be a little bit tweaked because this is how the mythologies are, but a person with half a brain cell can realize that this is a description very much like the old Egyptian idea of the primordial hill, you know, arising from the abyss. So many mythologies have this idea of a land mass that is quite small, but then it enlarges, because what the story of that is that the waters are actually receding, and the people are grateful because the lakes are there again, which have fresh water that they can drink. And so the whole of, you know, creation is born anew. It's really, really unbelievable when you get into these Irish legends, what they're talking about.
We're talking with Michael Tesarian, and my name is Patrick Timpone, and this is OneRadioNetwork.com. If you care to join us, here's a phone number for you. It is 888-663-6386. That is 888-663-6386. We'll put you on hold and then pick it up live on the air. You'll be able to hear the program on hold. Turn down your computer. For the shy among you, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. A question or a comment for our guest on this Thursday evening, the 29th of January. Mr. Tesarian has written lots of books. He does a show and a presentation called Origins and Oracles. One of his more popular books, Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation. A brand new DVD out called Architects of Control. And we'll be talking about the control and who is controlling who on a DVD. All of this available at Michael Tesarian, TSARION.com. He has lots of different websites that I'm sure you'll have links right there. And you can dig in and have a party. Mr. Tesarian, how then, this whole political thing is just a trip, isn't it? I mean, it's just amazing what's going on here. And it almost makes sense to me, your host, that if I didn't really believe in some kind of incarnation and karma and such, I would think that I was just, you know, really just been terribly unlucky to be experiencing the kind of people that we, the people of the world, experience in our politicians, regardless of what country you're in.
It is a question of perspective. That's how it does seem, obviously, to a lot of people. But you can mitigate that when we do, you know, do as I've been doing and study a little bit of history. And then you find out to your horror, I would say amazement and also horror, that this is, that these guys have always been around, that this kind of, duplicitous, greedy, misleading type of individual, you see, has unfortunately been around with us a very, very long time.
It's not something is that new. What we would call evil, and is it has always been on planet Earth, you suppose?
Oh, yeah. I mean, evil ultimately is the violation of nature's laws,
mm-hmm.
And it's also the violation of man's laws, the moral code. So, of course, absolutely, there's no question in my mind that there are evil acts and there's evil people, and the sooner that the human race really understands that, the better it'll be, because then we can get on with diagnosing those people of who they are, you know, and move on that, move down that line, you know, to really start to come very clear clear about what evil is and how it works.
But to the best that you've told with your mountains of research, Mr. Tesorian, that there's most often been people in control of other people and they've taken advantage of them in one way or another?
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. Absolutely. I refer to this throughout all my work, as the action of the colonization of not only in a political sense, which, of course, when we use those words, like colonization and colonialization, we're always thinking in military terms or we're thinking in terms of some political action.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to really start to get to understand that this is also has a psychic level. There's a whole other psychological dimension of how people are controlled and also how they allow themselves to be controlled. This is where my work really comes alive. I mean, yes, I do work. My work is controversial. It does talk about a hidden elite. And, you know, it's fascinating to look into all of those questions of the controllers and who they are and what weapons are using. But at the same time, I believe that a lot of the researchers in my field have a tendency to leave consciousness at the door, and they're mm-hmm. not asking the bigger psychological questions of how man comes to be, constantly be putting himself in a state of servitude and in a situation of submission. We also have to look at that question as well in today's age.
So you're suggesting that we as soul human beings, we are making a conscious decision or unconscious decision of allowing someone to control us by giving up our power in one form or another.
Yeah, okay, that's exactly the way to say it. That's precisely it. And it is unconscious. That also needs to be brought out. Nobody, of course, will consciously go for it. I mean, it's conscious to a degree, of course, but that's because Big Brother has co-opted our need to submit, and then puts it in front of us as, oh, you're being very patriotic, you're being respectful of authority, blah 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 blah. You know, so yes, it's partly conscious, but that's still manipulated allegiance. Ultimately, the true psychological complex or need to submit is unconscious. This is why it's so dangerous. You see, this is why my work focuses on it a lot, is to make people a little bit aware. And remember, this goes not just for them political submission. Once we are into that arena, once we're observing that particular vice, that's what turns up in relationships. That's what turns up at the place of work. That's how most people are running their lives. There's some sort of master-slave dichotomy happening even in the most mundane areas of the world, you know. And it's not just found in the corridors of power. This is something that could end up affecting our lives on all levels, you know.
So it's the idea that if we continue to live in this control of master-slave relationship, then we do the same thing in other parts of our life with a woman in our life or a man or whatever, and it's a dysfunctional kind of a relationship.
That's right. I'm very, very, adamant about that. We find it in religion. Of course, religion is very much based on, or false religion, let's say, is based on that. And unfortunately, it does creep into the domestic relationships. How parents have a tendency to treat their children is very dominating and hierarchical. There's how men traditionally, you know, had a relationship with women, let's say. And then, of course, now what's happening in the corporate world, you know, and so forth and so on. So there's the whole idea of domination is exactly the same thing as how people allow themselves to be remotely controlled by government. Yes, but it may be fun and it may be cool, it may be trendy, you see, to keep talking about some hidden elite dominating everyone, but wait a minute, what are we doing in our own personal lives? You know, what are we doing in our own relationships? What are we doing in our marriages? What are we doing at the places of work? Those are injustices as well, and in a way, it's just a matter of dimension and perspective as to which one is worse. So this is where you go when you start heading into the psychological area. You know, how many people listening to us right now have had dealings with slum lords, or has dealings with a tyrannical kind of a boss, a person who's an overseer or some unbearable, you know, creature at work, or how many of us have had this kind of tyranny in our relationships? You see, so it's a tremendously ubiquitous thing here, and so going to the psychological dimension helps us to get a grasp on even that kind of tyranny, as well as the one that we, you know, is more macro, and it's a little bit more on the larger political scale.
Uh-huh. Here's our phone number if you care to join us. Email questions, or you can call. Here's a phone number, 888-663-6386 for Michael Tesorian, or patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Here's an email from Dr. Sutter, Dr. Kenneth Sutter. He's talking 2012, The Destiny of Man. I think, isn't that a, is that's a work of yours, Michael Tesorian?
I have several works with 2012, so, several writings, but he's probably referring to the DVD,
yeah,
which is
maybe
called,
so.
It's called 2012, yeah, Where History Ends.
And he said, well, what do you see after? And he's just going to skip right over 12, which I was going to ask you about, but go ahead and we'll take the email question. What do you see after 2012?
Well, this is also the theme, by the way, of the new DVD, Architects of Control, and which deals a lot in this question of, you know, the countdown to 2012 and also what might potentially lead beyond. Let me first say, of course, that I do not believe that the world is going to end or any of that, catastrophic stuff. But what I do believe is that there's going to be there is already happening, and there will be at that time, a radical change in lifestyle and also in thought patterns and also behavior. I think we're on a countdown to the beginning. 2012, you see, that date might be a milestone. It might be the beginning of what is known as the post-human or trans-human world. And what this means...
Post-human? Post-human? Yeah, does that mean we humans are going to go away?
It means that what is human will go away within the human. And believe me, that's already happening. Within the human, all that really constitutes true humanity is already in a sort of a senility stage. So 2012, you see, my reading of it is that is what is basically happening, where man, the robot, man, the artificial creature, man, the creature who is either drugged, medicated, you know, and utterly a member of a global village type situation. This is, to me, what is defined by the transhuman or the post-human world, in which basically all the idioms that we grew up with, all the things that our forefathers understood about virtue and morality and community and all of these kinds of things, it will be no more, basically. And you see, this is being described by people as time speeding up. There's different ways that people have sort of alluded to this.
Go ahead, sir. Sorry.
Well, we only need to look at what Big Brother is up to with the whole move with this super technology and the genome project, and also the working on the organic computer with the super surveillance, with the RFID chips, with all sorts of brain implants and types of things. You see, there's something going on here. It's quite alarming. And also, remember, my work has a lot to do with studying the symbolism of the various corporations and the various... individuals who have these orgs, these think tanks, who are behind this kind of super technology, you see, has always been worrisome to me, because I recognize those symbols that these people are using. These are symbols that come out of Freemasonry. They're symbols that come out of the Knights Templar. They're symbols that come out of the Rosicrucians and the Illuminati and various other orgs. So there's a bit of a tie in there with the worrisome symbolism that these people are using in their commercials and their advertisements and their logos and emblems, that lets us know that there's an occult agenda behind this move towards greater and greater and greater technology and greater, greater sort of global village, one world order situation.
Yes. So it's no accident then that it's working towards a big, total global monetary control with the corporations and the banks buying all the assets. I mean, it's a well-planned event, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's right. It is the acquisition through the federal banks. This doesn't mean banks on the local level, although people want to keep your focus on the fact that, because remember, in the hierarchy of control, it's very important that people don't look too high up the pyramid. So when you have an economic meltdown or upheaval, just like it was in 1929, they do want to keep your focus on the street level, thinking that it's just local credit unions and local banks, blah, blah, blah. You know, and they don't want to see the strings of control that work from the federal level. Of course, this has been a little bit compromised, because we have great scholars now who are letting you know that it works a little bit higher up. You know, you have the Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin and Jordan Maxwell and so many other great writers who've led us in to understand that this is a federally controlled problem, and that when you do have any kind of material or physical or economic meltdown, it's not by accident. It is by design. It is stage managed. You know, this is the key thing to remember also. It's not just freaks of nature that we have this constant influx of trauma. We have these constant recessions. We have this constant threat, you know, of outsourcing and all the rest of it. There's reasons behind this. You know, if people come to my websites, as you said, you know, we have a lot of videos and a lot of writings on this subject so that people can understand that these people in control and the people who control the government are no friends of humanity. They do not even serve the countries that they appear to be in. in exactly the same way that the various royal families of history. You may be referring to them by Duke of Kent, Prince of Denmark, or the Prince of Greece, or Belgium, or the Kaiser of Germany, or the Tsar of Russia, and all of this kind of thing. But you see, that's actually, again, a misnomer, because none of these people really give a monkeys about the land or the nation that they rule. If they did, they wouldn't be sending their people to die in hideous wars down through the centuries. One of the greatest confusions is we think that these royal families actually have an allegiance to the various countries that they're in, including the British royal family being British. These individuals are a global, one-world family dynastic concern that has their roots in Belgium, in Holland, in Italy, you see, and going back even before that. So they have no understanding of what you're talking about when you're saying nationhood. That's just for the public display. That's just for the flag wavers. These people are globalists. They've always been globalists. They are now the force behind the MEPs and the European Union, and European Commission. They're pushing that as they always pushed it before. They were behind Adolf Hitler just as strong as anyone was.
Mm-hmm.
And they still remain in power today. And the thing that really is alarming is that they are in control of the American government. This is the problem.
Yeah. So we have here the Federal Reserve, and we have the J.P. Morgan, Citibank, and the big banks that run the Federal Reserve and essentially run this government. Who in your research are the some of the key players that are these names that we might recognize, Mr. Tsarian, the key players around the world that would be like at the big table if there were a meeting among all these people? Would we recognize some of these people? The names?
A lot of them you would recognize. The Queen of England, Prince Philip, the Duke of Kent, Mark, the Duke. Duke Mark, you know, there's the families of von Thyssen in Europe, for instance. You have all sorts of royal groups, and if you pick up an encyclopedia or you pick up my work, and you even see names like the Savoy family, you see, and the Lombards. They control the banking down in London, you see,
because
you mentioned Citibank and these other banks and stuff like that. Rothschild, J.P. Morgan, Kuhn & Loeb, the list is endless. We've written about these names, and we have information on these people. Absolutely, you'd recognize them, and it's always good to realize that it is a hierarchy. These people do go back to certain British organizations like the Club of the Isles and the Alpha Lodge of Freemasonry, to a group that's known as the Knights of the Order of St. George and St. Michael, or more correctly, the Order of St. Michael and St. George, and also the Knights of the Garter, you see. These are the Knights of Malta, the Knights of Columbus. You have many Freemasonic organizations, which, again, on paper, it's a little alarming, because when you start to look at who the list of people who have been given these knightly orders and who's when they've been bestowed these awards, you find that there are people from both sides of the so-called political spectrum. This is one of the things that is a little bit of a giveaway, that something's not right here, is that how can you have, in, say, for instance, let me give you a specific example, the Knights of Malta, who are also, headquartered in Rome, and who are linked to the order of the Hospitallers. How can it be that in the same order, you have people like Nelson Mandela, who's considered an extremely left-wing, socialist type of individual, a sort of a freedom lover and a humanitarian, and in the same order features people like von Papen, the Nazi, and people like Hermann Göring, for instance, and Benito Mussolini, and a host of the most extreme right-wing fascist demagogues that the world can imagine. I've got questions for the person who joins. I'd like to ask them personally, how is it that you would even accept an honor from any of these people when you know fine rightly that they also house your apparent opponents? But maybe I don't even need to ask the question, because I've done my research and I've worked out that behind the lodge door of these different organizations, it doesn't mean anything that you're left or you're right or you're Catholic or you're Protestant or you're Jew or you're Muslim, or even that you're really rich and poor. That does matter. But all of these divisions that we're familiar with in the marketplace, so to speak, have absolutely no meaning once you're behind the lodge door. That's purely for the balcony. That's purely for the marketplace. That's purely for everyone to be tearing each other apart, like you said before. you know, that this political action is really a joke, as you said, and, you know, we're not getting anywhere with that. That's right, and it's designed that way. It's set up that way. But, you know, if I could just want to let your audience know a couple of names as well.
Is
Lyndon LaRouche has written extensively. He's got a group that includes people like Webster Tarpley as a great scholar. So anyone who's fascinated with this, they don't have to look very far. They can. There's actually American writers who've done amazing work on showing who these names are and also who's behind, who's really the architects of control. So, you know, I would recommend Dope Incorporated, the book by the Lyndon LaRouche group. And we have Dr. John Coleman. And so if people go to my website and click on, if they go to michaeltessarian.com, click on the next button, they'll see an article I wrote. And the article is called Weapons of Mass Destruction Found. And in that article, you'll have the links to these various scholars in an American context who've blown the whistle on all of this. So, you know, thank you for giving me the time to mention that.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, I've often wondered, Mr. Tessarian, over how is it that there aren't some of these people that just break away and tell the truth about what's really going on? It's almost like they're controlled at some deep level, spiritual level, or... What does your research show in that regard?
That's one of the most important questions, and I thought about it, especially when we were doing the Architects of Control DVD. This question came up with my colleagues, the co-producers. It has many levels of answer. The first one is that there are some people who break away. That's the first thing to understand, and that my work specifically is in fact indebted to those whistleblowers who have been inside the church, who have been inside the military, who've been inside big government, and who have even been inside some of these secret societies I've been talking about. So they have, in fact, for a while been writing. Of course, it's not a lot. So in a way, you're right. But just as a side point, there have been people who have blown the whistle from within. There's been evidence of this, just like there has been recently with like Scott Ritter, you know, the UN weapons inspector, who just couldn't take it anymore and said, look, what on earth is this? And we've had whistleblowers from within the White House during the Bush administration and so on. So it does happen. But getting to the heart of your question, though, I do believe it is something spiritual. I do believe there is a form, what I refer to as the sorcery. There is something working on a very, very deep, dark spiritual level that, you know, it would be in context when you start talking about these more secret bodies and elites. But even if we don't go for that, then we have the physical control. We have the sort of mafioso level of control in which they do compromise politicians. In the secret societies, there's even evidence, you see, that these politicians are from a long line. They're generational Satanists, or they're generationally connected to the various, you know, Masonic bodies. And by that, I'm not implicating ordinary Masons who are well-meaning people and philanthropists and so on. I'm talking, you know, people need to be familiar with my work, that we're talking about a very high level here within Freemasonry, a sort of a hidden Luciferian group within Freemasonry that I refer to as the Atenists. So there's a control that these people have over their own lieutenants. This can even involve, you know, photographing them in compromising situations.
Mm-hmm.
It can involve having sort of a control, because you know something about their sexual proclivities, you see, and then you've got them in the bag. Or it can be in other ways, that you actually do have them participate in certain rituals, which there's even rumors that this involves the murder of children and other terrible, terrible acts, in order, again, in the early stages, to try and compromise this guy who's maybe power-hungry and greedy enough or stupid enough to do this. And then, of course, well, it's history then. Once you've... He may be thinking he's just going through some sort of, Dionysian-type ritual. He may have been programmed into believing that what he's doing is right for his own spirit, that he needs to break through certain codes that hold everybody else down. He needs to be free of all moral restrictions, and he needs to be one of these, you know, in the old sort of Grecian style, that these rituals are about breaking free of all sort of religious and moral controls. You can never go towards the light, you know, of Lucifer and all this palaver. They believe a lot of this stuff, not realizing that that's all a bunch of nonsense. The reason why they're having you do all of this cloak and dagger stuff is because they want something on you later on when you're going to be, you know, working for them.
Sure. So back to the emailer's question. So do you think it's possible that that's maybe our job, those of us who aren't part of this, which is the great majority of us, have to perhaps let go of attachment and hate and fear and greed and those kinds of things to get to this kind of post-human idea after 12. Could that be what this time is about? More spiritual involvement for all of us who want to?
No, there's no question that that's what it's about, and that's what all of our life is about, from the moment we're born till the day we die. It's about, you know, discovery of selfhood. It's about discovery of our virtues and our hidden gifts. And also, I would amplify that by saying it also involves discovering what hate, anger, violence, violation is. You see, how can you let go of something if you don't know really what it is? And as people like Nietzsche warned us, you don't want to also throw the baby out with the bath water. Maybe we've been told a pack of lies about certain emotions. Maybe we have certain virtues within us that we don't even understand. Maybe anger, maybe even certain levels of violence are necessary, because what happens if those happen to be defense reactions, just in the same way that the white blood cells will react, or your human immune system will act when it's under attack? How do we not know that many of the things that we imagine are negative in a certain personality or are negative might in fact be the very arising because there are subconscious reactions to being under attack? And if we don't know we're under attack, then of course we might have a myopic understanding of human behavior, which again is then co-opted by Big Brother, who knows exactly how to make use of our blindness in this regard. So yes, it is about spiritual evolution, and yes, it's about freeing ourselves from all of these different kinds of vices, but you first have to diagnose what those vices are, not in the way that we've been hitherto understand. There's a different way to look at the emotions, there's a different way to look at the dynamics of what is going on, so that we come to understand some more subtle things about this particular, you know, war on consciousness and this particular levels of colonialization that's going on. Because it's all well and dandy to be talking about love and forgiveness and charity and all of these things. We've got to understand a lot more fundamentals than just that. It works exactly the same way as the human the body immune system works, so it happens on other levels as well.
So do you think that those of us who are not them are could perhaps be called upon in some way to protect ourselves from these people?
Yeah.
I suppose that we're protecting ourselves spiritually simply by not, you know, buying into their, you know, to their game. But then what about on the physical level? How gritty do you think it's possibly going to get in the next few years? Have you thought about that?
It can go either way. What I'm seeing is that, I believe that there's a core of truth within most human beings. And that particular energy of truth, that nucleus of truth, is always radiating, but it gets covered over and over with debris.
Uh-huh.
So if this was just a matter of moving furniture on the Titanic and it was all hopeless, then of course it would be pointless, and maybe we'd even deserve what we're going to, you know, get down the line. But the thing is that there is already a spirit of rebellion within all human beings. I believe most men, unless you're psychopathic, they do have a natural understanding of what it is to be between right and wrong. I believe this is inbuilt. And therefore, it's only through constant drip-feed manipulation, it's only through the various forms of this, like this war on consciousness, you see, that the human race gets skewed and slightly, you know, tilted, and then off into some other sort of, you know, terrible, terrible side road, some terrible route to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening now is there's a spirit awakening that is going to sort of create a division by which, you know, the people who are people originally of virtue, what's happening in the world is actually, I believe, fated. It's come because it is time now, because again, there's a strange thing about human nature is that they never change until, you know, things get hot. So a lot of the conflict that we're seeing in the world actually has a spiritual aspect to it in order to help people, you know, really start coming alive now. Getting back to some of the older values, understanding what is the difference between virtue and non-virtue, and then there's a group of people, of course, you know, who are not going to make it. They have no spiritual core. They are people who are just committed to living on the surface of themselves and working in the power dynamic. And there's another group of people who are being called to awaken and to find their center again and to find their bliss and also attach, as you said, to nothing and let go and see it as an adventure rather than as some sort of crisis.
And there are many people out there that I've talked with, and your host may be included in this, that it's almost a blessing to be here now, because what a better way to really tell the difference between good and evil and right and wrong in such a, you know, this huge dynamic of up and down and light and dark as we're experiencing now. I mean, it's so absurd out there that it's just like unreal on some levels, on many levels.
Yeah. And it's also a good thing because you were talking there about the practical levels. What I also see there is that, you see, people are now starting to learn more about permaculture. They're starting to learn more about sustainable living, just as people have learned about recycling and vegetarianism or what have you, you see. So don't forget that when the pressure's on and people see, there's a tremendous capacity in people. We saw this during the First and Second World War where people got together, people found solutions. It was almost like a euphoric in many ways in which people bonded in a way that they never have done before or since. So yes, crisis is bad. It's not good, you know, in its own way. But again, when you pull back from the canvas, you start to realize that the human being is a very strange creature. He literally does roll over and go to sleep when everything is just wonderful and everything, and the sun is shining. You know, unfortunately, he becomes very, very apathetic. This is certainly the case in the American context. So strange as it seems, Mother Nature, you know, that God force or whatever you want to call it, has a particular way of bringing reality right there in front of you when it needs to be there, and people have the resilience to, you know, be motivated. So what I'm seeing now, especially amongst the young, in fact, the DVD we just did is very much focused on the newcomers to this kind of information. So I believe people were preaching to a little bit too much to the choir with this. And it wasn't enough addressing of the new people who are coming into this by the thousand every day.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a focus of ours. But again, you know, there's a lot of awakening taking place here and a lot of questions being asked about people. And I hope that that does mean that they will also not just be running around looking for political and social solutions. I hope that it will have the spiritual component in which people also change emotionally. Well, they also start looking to the inner house. And they start looking to their psychology. This is important, as well as other kinds of, you know, renovation.
Now, you travel a lot, Mr. Tsarion, and how what differences or similarities are you finding in Europe, greater Europe, with awareness, with proactiveness, with the bravery or adventurous people into these matters with compared to, say, the United States?
It's like night and day.
How so?
That the people in Europe are pretty much clueless.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought they were ahead in so many areas with the Germans and the health and the GMO and a lot of things like that. And they just banned mercury fillings in Sweden, which it'll probably take 20 years for us to get here. So I was under the impression they were a bit ahead in many areas, but you say not.
In some areas, there's a lot of... When you asked the question, I was thinking more about the whole question of the New World Order
okay.
and the conspiratorial.
It's very different. We're much more aware in this country.
Oh my God, it's like night and day. I mean, you only have to get David Icke on and ask him about his little life.
Yeah, we talked to David last month. He was just great.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a perfect example. Of course, I don't include all the people.
Sure.
You know, we have wonderful relationships with people in Europe who email us and a certain amount in Eastern Europe, and especially Australia. I got a lot of important contacts in Australia, a few in South Africa.
And New Zealand, too. They're very active down there. We have a lot of listeners in New Zealand.
Yes, that's true. So they do exist, but this is a subculture. This is and of course, you only have to ask them.
Sure.
These are people who will be the first people to tell you that they have no one that they can talk to, that they have no one. Everyone
really?
Thinks they're kind of, crazy. And you really will see that if you walk around. You'll get totally blank stares if you ever try to, you know, whereas in America, you know, I got partly into this because they were telling me I would stop at the bus stops in America when I went to work, and you know, guys would be pulling out dollar bills, going, "Hey, man, do you see this? You know, and this is about the federal control and stuff like that." You know, in bookstores and in the streets, you know. So yeah, you know, there's still a lot of people in America who need to wake up. But believe me, it is completely different. You have metaphysical bookstores who have this information. You have websites galore. You have a tremendous interest. You even have orgs. You have organizations, full-fledged organizations like the Melbury organization that deals in succession, you know, and,
sure.
and various other legal rights. You've got author after author after author that I can mention, and most of them are, apart from, say, John Coleman, and he thinks of himself as American, by the way. He long ago moved and became an American citizen, so even he lives in America. So if you have a list of the books that I've got on my reading lists, or you look at the various authors and titles and YouTubes, you're going to see it's American. It's even the young kids who are putting up these little YouTubes, you see, on symbolism and on various aspects of what they're doing. Your show, you've got Alex Jones, you've got Coast to Coast, you have Jeff Rentz, you have, you know, so many other great programs on there. Where are they all? Where are they all? They're in America.
In America, yeah. Know the source on One Radio Network.